Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, we got a big guest. We got a big, big guest here. We have John Doe. He played in a band called The Randoms. He played in a band called Black Randy and the Metro Squad. And he played in a little band that some people like called X. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to DamienAbraham.com. There's an email address there. You can send me an email. You can also find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damien. If you would like to support this podcast, you can do so by rating it on iTunes or writing a review or just telling everyone you know about it and spreading the word, because that seems to be what's happening. A lot of people have hit me up in the last couple weeks and said that they've just found out about this podcast and are checking it out, and I really appreciate that. I really appreciate people telling people about it and people checking this thing out, because we have fun over here. And also, I very much appreciate the help and love and support of my brother, Tristan Abraham, who's the producer on this show. He also runs the Facebook page. You can find us over there at Facebook.com/turnitapunk, and he puts stuff up on there, and you can write to him. He gets messages to me. He might be the best way to get a message to me, to be honest with you. So find that over there on Facebook. And also, I have to say a huge, massive thank you to the fine folks at Vans. Vans Shoes has come on board. Vans, of course, you know, been around forever, been involved in, you know, this music forever. Ian MacKay's wearing them. Yeah, that's right, on that live video, Ian MacKay's got his old school Vans on. So the good folks at Vans have come on board and helped make this thing possible for me to do and get some equipment upgrades and things like that, and also go to those great House of Vans things. And they don't tell me who I can and can't book on this show. They don't try and force guests upon me. They don't make you guys write surveys or any of that stuff. So thank you so much, Vans, for helping me out with this thing, and everyone at Vans for, believing in this one, you know, believing in this podcast. Because if you believe in things, you never know what happens. Like, you might wake up one day and you have John fucking Doe on your podcast. But once again, more on that in a second. Still over here in Japan, having a great time, trying not to buy too many records, seeing some unbelievable wrestling, even seeing some incredible bands. I've been to Japan like 4 times before coming here this time, and I don't think I saw anything, and now I've seen a lot more. So I am really enjoying it here. No weed, though. I've had no weed in a few weeks, so it's a kind of a little more high-strung Damien than usual. But that's okay. We're going to go home in a few days. But I am enjoying it while I'm here. Food's amazing. If you've never been to Japan and you have the means to get here, do it, because you will eat better than you've ate anywhere else in the world. Like, you can go to a 7-Eleven here and crush it for food. It's awesome. I'm having a great time. Anyway, I could go on about Japan forever, but that's what Footnotes is for. On this podcast, you want to hear just these interviews. So let's get to this one. So today on the show, we have John Doe from the band X and The Randoms and Black Randy the Metro Squad and The Flesh Eaters and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A legend. Someone I've gotten to actually interview, I think this is like my 3rd time interviewing him. Maybe more. I've gotten to play shows with him over the years, and you know, someone that is so cool. Like, what like the definition of someone who's like a cool dude. Like, he's just, you know, I'm sitting there in the room with him and this guy's just like oozing. It's like the Fonz or something. And John's also someone that is a musical genius. You know, he's played on countless records that I listen to seemingly weekly, and I kind of reveled in the opportunity to get a chance to sort of sit there and punish him about the early years. So this is a short podcast, unfortunately, because he had to go play a show, and it was a great show. I got to see it. So he had to go and get ready for it. But I did get a chance to kind of sit there and ask him about all these early singles and what it was like in the early years. So I'm not going to blather on anymore. I'm going to let you listen to John and I blather on now. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy John Doe on Turned Out a Punk. John, thank you so much for doing this.
You bet.
It's a big thrill. I've gotten to interview you a few times, but never in this kind of setting, which is my ideal setting, because I get to really nerd out, really go into like minutia with you.
You'll pardon me if I do less nerding. You can do all the nerding.
Okay.
And I'll just keep it straight.
You do the teaching. I'll be the nerding. So I guess I want to start this off the way I start them all off, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre? Whatever you define it as, too, by the way.
Yeah. I came across punk rock the first time I saw a John Waters movie. And I think the first time I felt stuck in the rafters watching Cream or something like that. Because I think punk rock is a ethos and it's a frame of mind, not a sound or tempo, although it's become that. And then it became more defined as, you know, we were listening to probably Patti Smith or the Stooges, even though I really only heard a little bit of the Stooges back in the early days. That came after I moved to California.
When you, I think it's in the history of punk, or the history of rock and roll, the punk episode, Lenny Kay talks about how when Patti Smith came to, or the Patti Smith group came to Los Angeles for the first time, you guys were in the crowd. Was that, did you see her on that first tour when they came through, or was that?
I don't think so. I might have been.
Memory.
I might have been. I don't remember. I think it was at the Roxy's, but I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I was a fan at that time. So I have clearer memories of the Damned and the Ramones and Blondie. Mm-hmm. Television. They all played at the Whiskey. That was more for the traveling bands, and the Starwood. Those were our places.
When you got to... I guess jumping back, where did you see the John Waters films the first time? Do you remember the theater, or was that...
I don't know, in Baltimore somewhere.
Yeah.
Some, probably, maybe at... maybe at the Maryland Institute of Art.
Okay.
Or maybe just at some theater.
Did he have like a cult following at that time in Baltimore?
He's from there. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. But like, was there...
Sure. He was the only famous person in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Except for maybe the mayor, who was an idiot, and Marvin Mandel and Spiro Agnew, who was a criminal. But all politicians in Maryland are suspect. So, yeah.
It's everywhere,
too. But he was available. I mean, he and all of the people that he worked with, all the people that worked in his movies, lived and... hung around in Fells Point, which was a kind of dilapidated part of the Baltimore Harbor. And the Baltimore Harbor hadn't been redone to become Harbor Place, or as everyone calls it in Baltimore, Horrible Place. And so it was just, you know, that they were luminaries, but it was attainable.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk a little bit about that in that Under the Big Black Sun book.
Mm-hmm. What was the music scene like around them? What was the music that people in that scene were kind of listening to or gravitating towards at that time? Like the Thugs or something like that? Or
No, it was more glam, glitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, T-Rex, David Bowie, and that kind of thing. We were this friend of mine and I were playing at Bertha's, which was a place that John hung out a little bit, and so did Mary Vivian Pierce and. We'd play just covers and kind of country rock stuff and things like that.
So when you get out to Los Angeles, is Rodney's English Disco still happening, or has that scene kind of died off by that point?
I think it was happening, but I'd never went there. I remember where it was, and I think that place is torn down now, but I don't think I ever went there. That was a little... before my time. I got there at the end of 76, like November of 76.
So when you get there, is there stuff happening there? Like, obviously in New York, everything's going on, but there, like, Zolarex, I guess, would have been done.
They lived in the building that Exene lived in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were they still playing at that point?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Maybe.
So what were the bands when you first got there that were kind of going on that you were kind of seeing?
The Motels, the Pop, the Dogs, mm-hmm. and I think that's about it that I remember. And they were starting to do shows on their own. I mean, they were starting to organize shows at the some like social halls. They were doing some DIY stuff then.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were kind of the beginning of people getting frustrated not being able to play the regular clubs because the Whiskey had disco going on and the Starwood had cover bands. Quiet Riot was one of them. But we also saw like Cheap Trick at that, you know,
oh, that's awesome.
Within the first probably 77 within the first year.
So when like the Pop and all those bands, it's funny. Did you ever see the Last too? Because those bands were putting up their own.
I think
singles.
So. Yeah, I think I did see that. The Last kind of snuck in to the Whiskey when they started doing new wave as well as punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did a lot more new wave than they did punk rock.
Yeah, it seems like it was like a real division in clubs. Like certain music was at one place, and you know, Madame Wong's was another type, you know, like it was a very mm-hmm. divided kind of place at a certain point. But it wasn't like that in the beginning, I can imagine.
Not really. I mean, I would say the best example would have been Madame Wong's versus the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown, because they were right next to each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, right across the courtyard. Trying to think of what the other new wave clubs were. Blackie's down in Santa Monica was more kind of new wavy, but then it also skewed more towards roots music. But the Whiskey didn't really embrace punk rock until the Mask was pulling in 200 or 300 people, and they were realizing that their place was empty. And they thought, oh, well, maybe this isn't so bad after all. They, you know, because, you know, it's kind of a philosophical discussion because, you know, punk rock to them was messing up their good plan, which became classic rock. You know, it was kids that didn't want to play the game and bands that didn't want to play the game the way that they wanted them to. So it was more serious. It was more for real, and so they were pretty resistant. And then, you know, the Sex Pistols fucking stuff up and pissing off journalists and you know, saying that we're here to end rock and roll and saying we don't, you know, fuck you, we don't care about you. And then, you know, the media just said, okay, fine, fuck you too, and we're not going to write about you, and you're fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Go, you know. So that was our, you know,
that was what you had to come up against.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the Ramones and Blondie and us and, you know, even though we were a year or so later, we wanted to be the next version of what rock and roll music was. I mean, even Dick Clark, when we finally got on American Bandstand, went to Exene and said, so what's the deal? Why won't radio stations play your music? It's great. And Exene said, well, you're fucking Dick Clark. You tell me, you know. But it was this, you know, it was because it was too real.
Yeah.
And it wasn't ready for prime time. And maybe, you know, maybe that's good in a way. Maybe that's all we were meant to do.
When, like, going back to when you first get there, it's pretty soon after that you must have hooked up with the Danger House people, right? Because that Random single comes out, what, 78, right? Or 76?
Beats me, 77.
Recorded.
So I think X single was out in 78. That's when we came to New York for the first time. Yeah, I mean, they were just somebody who was doing something, and mm-hmm. and nobody else. We didn't really get, you know, Greg Shaw was doing, with Bomp, was doing more kind of English influenced. Who was on that? 2020 and
the Last Sunset Bomber came out on that.
Right. Dwight Twilley and some people.
Plimsolls, like, I think.
Plimsolls, you know. So it was a little more, it wasn't as much what we wanted to do, and nobody else would even entertain the idea of signing us. And so, you know, eventually we got with Slash, and that was when people said, oh, you guys have sold out. And we said, okay, fine, we've sold out.
It's funny, though, because, like, that initial group of bands in L.A., like I was talking about, it seems so diverse, like the Screamers, you guys, the Weirdos, like Alley Cats, like everyone's doing something so different, but yet you all are kind of, what were you all kind of galvanized by? Like, what brought you together, do you think?
That punk rock ethos that I was talking about at the beginning, mm-hmm. just doing stuff yourself and doing something that you felt was from your... you know, heart or intuition rather than something you were a virtuoso at doing. Even though Billy was a, you know, terrific player, he wasn't playing with his head. He was playing with his whole body. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were just all kind of misfits and all a little bit outcast. And so that's what kept us together because we didn't feel like... we didn't feel like we could do it on our own, and probably couldn't have. I mean, that was a big part of the Under the Big Black Sun book, is that I wrote it with the same feeling and intent that the Scene had, which was like community and collaboration, because I didn't want to tell the story just myself, because as much as I might embrace East LA and their influence on the scene, or women and their contribution to the whole punk rock thing being equals and stuff, I can't write from that point of view. So that's why Exene is writing in it. That's why Dave Alvin is writing it, wrote a chapter, because he knew what it was like for the roots musicians or roots bands to come into this punk rock world. And, you know, everybody in that book has a topic, mm-hmm. like a subject. Mm-hmm. Jane Wiedlin's was about living at the Canterbury, because where people lived is what where all the ideas got exchanged. Those were our salons, you know, for even though we weren't like Hemingway and stuff like that.
Hemingway to me, John. No. Hemingway to me.
No. So yeah, that's what kept us all together. But I would say that you could say the same thing about English punk rock. You could say the same thing about the New York scene, is that, you know, television and the Ramones and Blondie and Talking Heads and who am I forgetting? Suicide, all these bands that really created this scene, yeah. and sound, you wouldn't mistake Talking Heads for, you know, television.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't mistake, like, the Sex Pistols for... The Damned or The Clash or X-Ray Specs or Susie and the Banshees or, you know, so, and I would even say that it's the same with the early SST bands. You know, Black Flag and the Minutemen and the Meat Puppets are all pretty different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe as time has gone on, punk rock is a little more codified, but that's, you know, that's evolution. And that was one thing that I was glad to also include in that book is you know, Jack Grisham had this, his chapter was about the rise of hardcore. Mm-hmm. And so his unrepentant attitude was, you started this shit, we finished it, what's your problem? And I mean, there's plenty of problems in that we got, you know, it was no longer like fun or safe for us to go to shows because people thought that we were the establishment or some bullshit like that and wanted to pick fights with me and wanted to, you know, spit on Exene and shit like that, you know. And sure, I mean, it is evolution, and now I can see it from a more objective point of view.
Even Jack talks about it in I forget which documentary, Rage, I think, about, you know, the kidnapping debutantes and shaving their heads. So it's obviously not necessarily a safe place for women too at that point. Like, right. I think, unlike that earlier scene where you have, you know, the Bags and
yeah.
Alley Cats X, everyone.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing I loved about that Under the Black Under the Big Black Sun is that that book has the I don't know, the ability. It's perfect because it has different voices in it, but then it also has everyone writing essays. So it's actually like not just like a soundbite. It's actually people like going into sort of like complex thoughts about the time and place, and it really is reflective of like there, you know, especially in that Jack chapter. There's like a defined end to that first sort of wave of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When to you was there like a specific moment where you're like the party's over?
No, not really. It was cumulative. I mean, when Darby killed himself, that was a sort of a result of the way things were going. He felt alienated from the people that looked up to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you say, there was some conservative ideas about, you know, homosexuality, and Darby was pretty confused about that. And so no, not one specific time, several times that we would try to go see Fear or the Middle Class or someone like that, and it was just like you'd stay there for an hour or so and suffer a certain amount of abuse and just say, fuck this, this is no fun.
Mm-hmm.
These are a bunch of hammerheads that don't know anything, and they're, you know, trying to get physical, and this is no fun. Fuck it, we're out. Yeah, but I would say that the difference between those the book that I worked on and like Please Kill Me or the Neutron Bomb or Give Me Something Better in San Francisco is that I asked the people to use a longer form, so you got a sense of their voice, and also I could fact check it because there's not a lot of fact. If you call up, you know, you called up Dee Dee Ramone and said, "Hey, Dee Dee, remember this time?" And it was all fucked up, and it's like blah blah blah. He answers, and then there's not a whole lot of fact checking because, and that's great because it's just like this is the story.
Yeah.
It also we got a bigger sense of the city of Los Angeles at the time because that was a huge influence. The, you know, openness and the horizon and the fact that people had cars and that's a kind of freedom and all that stuff. So
I think to me, like, when, you know, as an outsider looking from a different point in time, it, punk really becomes that true all around art form when it gets to LA. Like, that's when, you know, obviously there's people taking photographs and things like that, but you don't have the same sort of like importance placed on literature, on graphic arts that you do when it goes to LA, and it just seems like there's like an aesthetic that's kind of being defined about what this is. Is that a misreading?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that, but I don't. I think that all those elements were in New York and in London. You know, with people, the kind of art that was made for flyers and film. You know, film was really big in the, especially in the second wave of the, you know, no New York mm-hmm. bands mm-hmm. like Lydia Lunch and DNA and you know, Exene's Sister was in a movie that I don't even know if it still exists, called Ecstatic Stigmatic, and that was made by her husband at that point, Gordon Stevenson, and Beth B was doing a bunch of stuff, and you know, there's a bunch of underground kind of filmmaking, yeah. and maybe in LA there was more poster art, but everybody, I think, in all the, what makes a scene is that there's a bunch of people and everybody's doing something, even if it's just being fabulous,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and then there are the fashion element or icon in the scene.
So there's definitely a canon of that LA punk band. There's a canon of all punk, obviously, but there's a canon sure. of those LA punk bands. Who do you think is kind of left out of that canon, or at least underappreciated from that time? Maybe a band like, you know, the Screamers, never recorded in yeah. any sort of real way, but like,
well, the Weirdos were another one who never did a full record. I think the Plugs are sort of a underappreciated, the Alley Cats. Although the Alley Cats were a little bit more old-fashioned, they're a little bit more just a rock band. But because they looked strange and they were playing in the same clubs as us. But you know, some people waited too long, and the moment passed, and you know, the Germs were influential, but in a lot of, until they put that record out, they were like influential, but kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. And nobody took Darby seriously because his public persona was like a huge 12-year-old, you know, grown man, 12-year-old. And he, so, yeah. Who else is underappreciated?
What about Black Randy? I kind of think that's...
Oh, he was a force to be reckoned with. He was like a fucking hurricane. Or a tornado. Just not a hurricane, tornado. Much more surgical and unpredictable. Hurricane is a little slower moving. Yeah, he was viciously funny. Mm-hmm. And then he would make fun of other people, and then you'd realize, oh, wait a minute, when I'm not around, he's making fun of me. Maybe, but yeah, I loved playing in the Metro Squad. I was on a couple of those records.
Oh, yeah.
And it was awesome. He was a complete psychopath. He truly was. I mean, he wasn't dangerous all the time, but some of the time, for sure, he was. But that was part of it, in the seeking the edge, you know, seeking the other side. And I think that's a good thing. You know, you have to be careful because, and that's obvious because there's a lot of dead punk rockers. Either at the time or later through just wearing your body out or not having a strong constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about seeing the other side and reportage from the war zone.
What were those recording sessions like for like that and the random single? Because is that your first time in a recording studio when you get out to L.A.?
Yeah, I'd done recording in people's houses, but and to call them recording studios is unfair because it was two hotel rooms.
Yeah, true.
It was one hotel room where the 8-track console in quotes was, and then the other hotel room where the musicians were. It was a joke. I mean, we did it to the best of our ability, but it was, you know, we did like. It seemed to take forever to get going.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was over in a minute or 2.5 minutes. And then you do another one. I mean, we did the Randoms and Black Randy all in one day.
Wow.
Sure. I mean, it's not wow, really, because it's pretty shitty recording. Well, it's kind of dumb songs. And I think it's only because it has this immediacy. And it's kind of there's a lot of heart in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is it worth recording or worth listening to? But
is it worth paying $300 for on eBay?
Oh God, no. I mean, unless you're, you know, I mean, I suppose if you collect something, then you collect something,
yeah.
And then you know, it's like what anybody is willing to pay. I mean, you know, is a 60s Ferrari worth $1 million? I know, but it is to somebody who's got 50 million.
I take all 1,000 random singles.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I could talk to you forever, John, and I know you got to run, but I would love to eventually do a part two with you one day in the future. But I kind of wanted to just like leave it at, does it ever surprise you, given how ramshackle those recording sessions are, that how vital that music still sounds today? Or do you ever go back and listen to any of those singles or any of that stuff?
I don't listen to them. I probably should, just to remind myself,
mm-hmm.
You know, what it was like. I did a little bit, you know, when I was working on the book. Does it surprise me? It's flabbergasting. it's mortifying and shocking but it gives you a sense of accomplishment, and it gives you a little sense of being, you know, validated. But you have to be careful with that because you don't want to kind of puff yourself up and you want to realize that, no, you were a dumb kid that just wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. And so you were a dumb kid, but you did something, and so it's worth at least that much. It's worth the fact that you tried and you did, rather than listen to conventional wisdom and somebody saying, because that's why I left Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Everybody would say, oh, you can't do that. You know, because the East Coast is much more cynical than the West Coast. The West Coast is like, fuck yeah, let's give it a shot, you know?
I agree.
And the East Coast is more...
winter hardened.
Yeah, closed down. And you know, who do you think you are? You're from fucking Baltimore. It's like, okay. But then if you take yourself out of Baltimore, then it's like, oh, you're from Baltimore? What the hell happens there? And then all kinds of shit happened in Baltimore because nobody gave a shit. Mm-hmm. And everybody did art just for art's sake. You know, visual and musical. And, you know, now there's a lot of good stuff coming out of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Because it got left alone for a long time. But, you know, I'm proud of all the stuff, but you got to temper it with, like, don't get, you know, too big for your britches.
But history proved you right. You know, like, all those people that were detracting from you, you were right, because here we are all these years later talking about these singles, that two incredible singles recorded in one day that have changed countless people's lives and influenced so much music.
Okay. You know, the thing is that I'm proud of being a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
I'm proud that I'm still here and I'm still playing music and I'm making new music and people are still coming to see X. Yes. If you were to measure it by, like, how much money you made or how many records you sold, then it still is, you know, influential, but not very, not a good business model.
No. All right.
Your dinner chariot has arrived.
Awesome.
Okay.
Well, thanks so much, John.
All right.
Well, let's do this again sometime.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We certainly can.
Thank you, John, for coming on the show. And John, of course, is doing his thing. Also, pick up his book, Under a Big Black Sun, a great book with a lot of different people contributing to it, so you get a real different perspective on the LA punk scene. It's not like some of these punk history books, which tend to have a bias from the author in the way they edit it together, especially oral history stuff sometimes. Not all of them. There's some great ones out there, but occasionally in the past, there have been a couple books that have revealed a bias of the author, and I think John found a way around it with this one, because everyone's just like writing these essays and you kind of get a real, I'm sure there's a bias in editing that could be present there too, but you get a real range of perspectives on the early LA punk scene. So check out that book and check out, of course, you know, if you haven't checked out X, they've got a couple records you should listen to. And if you haven't checked out the Randoms or any of those early Danger House singles, they're essential. Absolutely essential. And there's bootlegs and there's official reissues from years ago. And I think there's even like more modernish reissues of the singles too. That label is perfect. Perfect. Pick up those records. That's it. That's it for this week's show. I'm going to go do more stuff here in Japan before I head back to Canada. Because when I get back to Canada, I got to put up next week's episode. And next week on the show, someone I got to meet and hang out with in Japan, a wrestler that I'm a huge fan of, Dave Crist, one of the top wrestler guys on the indie scene right now, about to make a debut on TV. And also, man, this goes deep. This is a heavy episode. This might be one of the most intense turned out of punks that I've had a chance to do. He was someone that grew up part of pretty, you know, and I think he says it in this, pretty violent scene in Ohio, and managed to get out of a very rough situation and has now found success and some level of happiness in professional wrestling. So yeah, it's a great episode. I really recommend you listen to it, even if you're not a wrestling fan. And even if you're not a fan of 90s hardcore, listen to this episode, because this, for just human survival, is an incredible story. That is next week on the show. Thank you so much for listening. Go out there and make your own culture. Do what you do, because there's going to be someone out there that also wants to see what you're doing. And that's it. Stay safe. I love you, and I'll see you next week. Bye.